Hi, this is Jason Greenblatt on The Diplomat, brought to you by Newsweek. In August of 2022, nine student groups at the Berkeley Law School, since that time those nine student groups has grown to 14, decided to issue bylaws not to invite or host speakers that have expressed and continue to hold views in support of Zionism or Israel. Two attorneys, Gabe Groisman and Arson Ostrovsky, have filed a civil rights claim against Berkeley Law, asking that the U.S. Department of Education investigate whether the school is discriminating against Jews. This is a fascinating and such an important conversation. We talk about Zionism, anti-Semitism, anti-Zionism. Take a listen, folks. I think you'll find it really, really important, and please share it. Again, I'm Jason Greenblatt. This is The Diplomat, brought to you by Newsweek.
Getting the smile and confidence you've been dreaming about, all from the comfort of your home, isn't a total mystery with Bite Clear Aligners. Just don't be surprised if all your friends start asking, what's your secret? Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. Bite Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
So pleased to have with me today two very special guests, Gabe Groisman, attorney, former mayor of Bell Harbor, spearheaded the first municipal BDS ordinance, does so much for the Jewish world and for pro-Israel causes, as does my other guest, Arson Ostrovsky, CEO of International Legal Forum, wages battles against terrorism, BDS, and other anti-Semitism. Gentlemen, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
So you're both heavily involved in Jewish and Israeli-related causes, as well as, I'm sure, many other things. One of your specific things that you focus on is fighting anti-Semitism, anti-Israel bias. And what I want to focus on today on this particular episode is the fight you're currently having, where you filed a civil rights lawsuit against Berkeley Law. We're all lawyers here on this thing, although many of my listeners are not. And you're asking that the U.S. Department of Education investigate whether the school is discriminating against Jews. Not a lot of people are actually following this. Not enough people are following this, I should say. So let's get into it. What happened at Berkeley?
I see Gabe pointing at me. You're touching something very important. I'll say why in a moment when you said that this is about discrimination of Jews. Which it is. It's something that in this case has been hidden behind or masqueraded behind the facade of discrimination against the Zionists, as if that is somehow any different or any more excusable, which it is not. What happened here was that in late August, a number of student organizations from the UC Berkeley Law School, nine at the time, passed a resolution quite simply saying that they will not invite any Zionist speakers or any speakers who quote unquote support the occupation of Palestine. There was nine groups at the time in late August. Since then, another five groups have jumped on board. So you have 14 in total. Now, what transpired after that is something which is quite unique in many ways. You have the dean of the Berkeley Law School, who's Jewish himself, say that under this formula that he too would be precluded from speaking to these groups. However, he then added that, but only a handful of student groups have endorsed this, when in reality it wasn't just a handful, it was nine groups out of 100 who are some of the largest groups in the Berkeley Law School. But the bigger issue here being that no one would ever say that only a handful of groups decided to prohibit speakers who are African-American, LGBT, women, Asian-Americans, and so on. But what it gets down to really the core of it is that the way this whole debate is being framed, it's being framed by the dean and others as a First Amendment free speech debate, whereas what we are saying that is an incorrect interpretation. In fact, it is willfully misleading, and that this is in fact an act of grievous discrimination, because Zionism, which is what this case is all about, goes down to the root of our identity as Jews. It's something that is integral, indispensable, and a core element of our identity. So when they're saying no Zionists, what they really mean is no Jews, which goes back to what you said in your introduction.
And my understanding is that the pledge itself was authored by Students for Justice in Palestine. It's a pernicious group. It appears throughout the country here. I don't know if it appears elsewhere around the world. Tell us about SJP, their activity. I think not enough people understand who they are and just how anti-Israel, anti-Semitic they are.
Yeah, I'll jump in on this one. And first to just to dovetail on what Arsene was saying earlier, you know, what's important about this resolution, people are saying, are these bylaws excluding Zionist speakers. It's not even speakers on Zionism. It's if you hold a belief held by over 90% of Jews, which is a core component of the Jewish identity, you can't participate, you can't speak to our group, not about scheduling, not about constitutional law, not about cooking, you can't speak about anything. And that's an exclusion of a group which is discriminatory under the law, which we can get into. SJP, Students for Justice in Palestine, is a group that's very, very active on college campuses throughout the United States, which lead many or most of the efforts around campus that lead to the isolation and discrimination and anti-Semitic acts against Jews and make Jewish lives miserable throughout college campuses. And I know if anyone from SJP heard me explaining that, they'd be happy with that explanation, because that's the goal of all of their efforts. There's a lot written about who's funding them, who's behind them, but really what's more important is the students that are involved in them. And you see students of all kinds jumping into this quote unquote just cause, which it's not. But it's not just the members of SJP that are making a splash. When you look at college campuses today, they're wrought with this concept of intersectionality, where you try to find groups that are allies, quote unquote allies, with your cause, and you, wherever your interests intersect, you go out and fight each other's fight. So SJP, just like in this one, you know, will go out and find different groups on totally different issues and get them to adopt similar bylaws and resolutions that are discriminatory. The effect that it has, and I was speaking to a student from Berkeley last week about this, and this is all over the country, and it's important to understand, is that in many college campuses in the United States today, if you want to join a group on an issue totally unrelated to religion, totally unrelated to the Middle East, it could be a women's rights group, it could be an immigration group, many of those groups have within their own bylaws anti-Israel, anti-Zionist, anti-Jewish bylaws and regulations, where their Jewish kids are being asked to check their identity at the door if they want to participate. And it's really causing a big disruption and a lot of difficulty for Jewish students around the country.
So, Jason, I would just add one thing. Sorry, but SJP, their logo, their motto actually says, "From the river to the sea, Palestine will be free." This group, they don't hide. They are very transparent. They don't care about two-state solution. They don't care about these borders or their borders. Their goal, quite explicitly, is to see the dismantlement of the state of Israel.
Right. So what's ironic is I also, like you, would not be able to speak here, or like the dean, I suppose, would not be able to speak here, join any of their clubs if I were at the university. But when I'm in the Middle East, throughout the Arab countries, and even when I speak to Palestinians, they don't hold the ones that I speak to, and even the ones that are thoroughly against the policies of the Trump administration and most of the things that I believe in, don't subscribe to these theories, meaning they may be as pro-Palestinian as one can get. They may be extraordinarily interested in what some call a two-state solution, which I think is a label that shouldn't be used. You know, all the arguments that they have about East Jerusalem and all that, but very few of them actually subscribe to this theory. Now, that's anecdotal. I didn't take a full poll. How did SJP become so successful at doing what they're doing? And you're fighting one battle, but it seems to me there's a cascade of battles that ought to be fought around the country.
Yeah, so two things, Jason. First of all, with regards to the second question, you know, in the United States, in academia, in the media, everything has become binary, right? Everything has been dumbed down to its lowest common denominator. It's good versus evil, white versus black. You see it applied to many different spaces in social circles and in academic circles. And really, the narrative of the Palestinians has resonated with different liberal groups around the country. And they just, it's a oversimplification and full of misinformation and disinformation, or just full falsehoods, right? And what the narrative is, but it fits perfectly into what is a popular narrative in so many circles around the country. So it's resonated. They've become, the tide has totally shifted. The Jewish community in Israel is always on the wrong side of that equation in the culture wars. And that's really where they've found a lot of success. And to your first point on the disconnect between what people in the West, in the United States and in Europe, tried to say about the Middle East and Israel and the Palestinians and the Arabs, it's them projecting most of the time with the way they look at the conflict and the issues that they see. And you see it all the time where most of the time what's missing and who's missing from many of these initiatives are Palestinians themselves. You just have liberal activists in the United States jumping on the bandwagon on these issues. And if you scratch at the surface, if you get one of them on the phone or pull one of them aside and ask them just two or three questions about Israel and the Palestinian conflict, they don't know. They crumble after the first question because they've just taken on this initiative as the right versus wrong, and they think they're taking on the right side of it with no information.
That's a really important point, and it's been my experience as well. There are certain ones who are well-trained with certain arguments, most of them false, I believe, or distorted, but really it's a handful of them, and when you engage with them in any kind of meaningful dialogue, they do crumple, as you say, and it's quite remarkable that they, even in places like Berkeley Law, where one would think there's a couple of smart kids at least, right, where they're able to get away with this.
You can have a reasonable debate and discussion with opposing minds and people who say disagree on this Israeli policy or that Israeli policy, you know, very well during your time as well. But there is no debate happening here. I mean, their position is point blank that Israel should not exist. There is nothing to debate with them. For them, if you even believe in Israel's mere right to exist, you are persona non grata. You are banned, you are prohibited, you are cancelled, you are excluded. There is no debate to be held with these people, which is really quite unfortunate.
So let's get into the legal theory of your case. Let's assume for all, you know, my audience are not lawyers, they're not judges. Explain to the general population what the case is all about.
So because UC Berkeley is a public institution, because they receive funds from the federal government, from the Department of Education, that means they fall under the purview of the Civil Rights Act. The Civil Rights Act is very clear. It states that anyone, any institution that does receive such funding from the federal government shall not prohibit on the basis of race, sex, or national identity. What we are saying is that because Zionism is something that is so integral and indispensable to Jewish identity, therefore Zionists and mostly obviously Jews, therefore being discriminated under these proposed Bibles. Furthermore, the university administrators have an obligation to take active steps in order to root out, respond, condemn, and take action against these discriminatory acts. And we are saying also here that on the contrary, not only is the university not taking these steps, but they actually aiding and abetting, specifically when you have, for example, the dean saying that only a handful of student groups are adopting such bylaws, which in effect is justifying mainstreaming and excusing such justification discrimination against these students.
So there's only a few haters, and that justifies it, I guess, is his position. Is that
his position... No, that is not. And, you know, we've certainly said, you know, irrespective of how many groups an act of discrimination has occurred, it's exactly the same as if, you know, if you're a workplace of employment and you're saying, and you're advertising for jobs and you're saying, well, we will not employ African-Americans or we will not employ LGBT people. It's exactly the same circumstances here.
Yeah, and I'll jump in. What's interesting is the dean is a legend in constitutional law. If you studied law in the last 20 years in the United States, you studied Professor Chemerinsky's constitutional law book. He was the main author of that. And I'm confident that he knows that the arguments that he's putting forward are fallacious. They're not proper arguments where he says, well, it's just a First Amendment issue. And this has been litigated since the 60s, where those arguments were made, where he said, well, I didn't want to allow, you know, black people to eat in this restaurant. It's a First Amendment issue. Okay. There are limits to the First Amendment, and the Civil Rights Act sets forth many of them, not all of them, but many of them. And that's exactly what's happening here. And what they've done, which is interesting from a legal perspective, rather than saying blatantly, Jews aren't allowed to speak at our groups, they said people that are Zionists or hold Zionist beliefs are not allowed to speak at our groups. And that's a core component of the Jewish identity. So the argument that we make in our brief, which isn't a perfect argument, but it helps illustrate what the position they're taking is, which is if you were to say that anyone who believes that Jesus is the Son of God cannot speak at our, participate or speak in our groups, that would be discriminatory and wrong. It would be discriminatory against Christians because that's a core belief of Christianity, even if there are some non-believers within Christianity. So that's essentially what they're doing. The First Amendment has nothing to do with this at all. This is a question about discrimination. The dean knows it. I'm sure he knows it. And he's in a position of being at an academic institution on the West Coast of the United States. It's not a, I'm sure it's not an easy position to be in.
Jason, can I just add two very, very quick things? One is that we are not suggesting here that the university or these groups ought to be inviting pro-Israel speakers, because that would be a violation of the First Amendment. What we are saying is that what we're seeing here is a wholesale exclusion of a group of people, i.e. Jews, on the basis of our ethnic identity. The other important point with respect to the legalities of it, in the previous administration, of course, under which you served, the president made an executive order, which, amongst other things, said that the White House administration will vigorously pursue anti-Semitism against Jews, including on campus. And there was an important reference in that executive order that in determining whether anti-Semitism has occurred, that a reference will be made with respect to the International Holocaust Remembrance Alliance definition of anti-Semitism. Now, this definition is very important. It's been adopted by some 30-plus countries around the world. The U.S. uses it as a tool as well, hundreds of civil institutions. And this definition very clearly says what is and isn't anti-Semitism. But with reference to Israel, it does say that the denial of Jewish people's rights of self-determination, which is Zionism, is an act of anti-Semitism. So that is something that is important here in terms of a guiding tool, in terms of also the determining why anti-Zionism is anti-Semitism.
Is that executive order still in effect? Has the Biden administration terminated that, or they still honor it and maybe don't enforce it, but they hasn't been ripped up, right?
It is in effect. It is still in effect. And what is interesting with this particular case of ours is not only is it the first time, in my understanding, that the case of really what is Zionism is featured so prominently, but what we've actually seen is the Biden administration, the first time they've sort of exercised the Title VI investigation with respect to what might be deemed, you know, left-wing anti-Semitism, attacks on Zionism. There's been other investigations open, but, you know, where it's been very clearly things like harassment against Jews, you know, making really some outrageous statements and so forth. But this is a really, I think, the first time it's been employed with respect to what might be deemed sort of left-wing or progressive Zionism.
And to clarify your opening, Jason, the last week, the Biden administration, the Department of Education announced that they were opening a formal investigation as a result of the complaint that Arson and I filed. You know, and that's really, really a landmark moment. Obviously, we're all waiting for what the results of that investigation are. But the fact that they even accepted it, you know, based on the argument that we put forward, which I think it's the first time it's really been put forward in the federal government in this form, at least in a complaint, is important. It's telling, and we have to acknowledge that we've taken an important step forward, and we hope to take many more to be able to quash this. But it really was a momentous occasion last week when they announced that.
Yeah, good for them. I applaud that, and thank you for starting this process. So hopefully there'll be many more of these. You know, we danced around this a little bit, but for the purposes of my listeners, because people sometimes don't feel confident in how they answer this question, could you define Zionism as you see it, and why anti-Zionism is really a modern-day form of anti-Semitism?
Sure, I'll take it if you want, Arson. So Zionism, it's very important, by the way. It's the most important question. Whenever someone says they're an anti-Zionist, it's at first you have to define what Zionism is. Then we could define what you're against, right? Zionism is simply the belief that Jews have the right to self-determination on their ancestral homeland in the land of Israel. That's what Zionism is. Zionism did not start in 1897 or 1894 with Theodor Herzl. It started in the Bible itself, in the five books of Moses. There's discussions in Deuteronomy specifically, in the fifth book of will be dispersed. The Jewish people, which began in the land of Israel in Judea, we're called Jews because we come from Judea, which is one of the regions in the land of Israel. And we would be dispersed amongst the nations, and then God would bring us back in the ingathering of the exiles to the land of Israel. When we were dispersed from the state of Israel, the land of Israel, there was always a continuous Jewish presence there. But when we were dispersed mostly from Jerusalem by outside invaders, became an integral part of the Jewish identity was the yearning to go back to the land of Israel to reestablish sovereignty there, like we did under King David and King Solomon. That is what Zionism is. We pray towards Jerusalem three times a day. We pray to Zion, which is another word for Israel, many times a day, and many times within our three prayers of a day. And today, what's happening is when there's groups that are trying to be anti-Zionist, saying we're not against the Jews, we're just against the Jewish belief that they have a right to self-determine in the land of Israel. Well, you can't do that. You can't say you're not against me, but you're against my left arm. Right? That's part and parcel of what it means to be Jewish. You could be against certain policies of the state of Israel. There's no one more critical of the policies of the state of Israel than Jews that live in Israel. But that when you're challenging or questioning the Jewish right to self-determination on the land of Israel, which is Zionism, that is an attack on a big part of the Jewish identity.
Yeah, sometimes we Americans are more critical of the Israeli government, as we see now all these hateful arguments in the New York Times, the Washington Post, even the Biden administration are making comments about how they're not going to speak to some people within the Israeli government, or they're going to hold Bibi Netanyahu accountable for them. I don't know who's the bigger critic.
It's interesting. Sorry, Jason, you mentioned that, of course, just the other day, President Biden, of course, announced the Hanukkah receptions, or bigger plan to combat anti-Semitism. And then I actually saw literally just an hour ago him posing for photographs with Ilhan Omar and Rashida Tlaib for Christmas photographs. And the interesting there specifically with respect to Tlaib specifically here is, only a few weeks ago or a month ago, she actually said that you cannot be Zionist and progressive. And it's important here because what really they're trying to do here is that they're trying to exclude Jews. They might be trying to masquerading it or hiding it as Zionists, but we know, and we need to call them out, because when they say no Zionists, we know very well that they mean no Jews.
So related to that, let's talk about BDS. When I was at the White House, believe it or not, most of my tweets, probably all of my tweets, were reviewed by the National Security Council, the State Department. I was able to say what I wanted to say, but they always reviewed them and gave comments. most of them were okay. Occasionally I fought with them, and most of the time I was allowed to do what I needed to do anyway. But I remember a particular instance of BDS where I called BDS anti-Semitic. Somebody was all in a huff about it. And in the end, President Trump agreed with it. In fact, he had said that same thing even before he became president. So I was able to issue the tweet. Explain, if you don't mind, to my listeners, why BDS is anti-Semitic.
Yeah, I'll go first, and there's lots of ways to answer this. So, I wrote and passed the nation's first anti-BDS ordinance in 2015. The BDS movement's been going on since 2006 or so. There's a lot of academic discussions. I studied philosophy. We can sit here and have lots of arguments why philosophically, theoretically, it is or isn't anti-Semitic. And we can do that. It's actually a lot of fun. But in practice, every single time there's the BDS movement is out and about doing their activities, you'll see it clear as day that it's just pure anti-Semitism. You have students at Jewish unions with being attacked and harassed by the BDS movement. People saying that they're not going to buy anything from Jewish groups or from anyone who does business in Israel or who goes to Israel or who does anything related to Israel. Again, just attacking Jews and as a euphemism towards Jews. And it's in practice, every single time the BDS movement rears its head, it's pure and simple anti-Semitism. Now, the movement itself, the boycott of the state of Israel, really, if you look at the IHRA definition, the IHRA definition of anti-Semitism, and it addresses it, when anti-Israel activities like the BDS movement cross the line into anti-Semitism, it's three times. It's the three Ds. It's first, if you're looking to delegitimize the state of Israel, it doesn't have the right to exist. when you're second is you demonize the state of Israel, where they're the cause and the root of all evil you find in the world. And third is when you apply double standards to the state of Israel that you don't apply to anyone else. And really a lot of that, when we're talking about now the details of the BDS movement, it's really in the third realm. It's a double standard that's applied towards Israel. It's not applied to anywhere else in the world. We saw it with Airbnb. We saw it with Ben and Jerry's, both of whom tried to, or temporarily did boycott the state of Israel or parts of the state of Israel under the guise of some sort of human rights BDS activity. Luckily, the levers that were put into place by many folks around this this chat and around around the country, you know, the pressure was able to be applied there, and they were able to back off. But you know, at the end of the day, when you see BDS in action, it's anti-Semitic every time.
Jason, I would just add that, you know, you only need to listen to the founders of the BDS movement, people like Omar Barghouti, who are very clear in terms of their goals. They don't care about. They don't care about a two-state solution of any kind. He's very, very specific that their ultimate goal is a one-state solution, a return of Palestinian refugees, and the end of Israel's existence as a Jewish state. So they don't care about which side of the borders you were talking about. That is the ultimate goal of the BDS movement as a whole. So those that are engaging in this movement, those that are supporting it in any way, they are ultimately aiding and abetting this plan.
In November of this year, Congressman Josh Gottheimer, a Democrat from my home state of New Jersey, sent a letter to the Secretary of Education urging him to investigate this. How important is that action, and are there other political figures doing this? And if not, how do we get other political figures to do this if that's an important step?
It's a hugely important step. And Josh Gottheimer is a great example. He was a Democratic congressman who's really taken on his own party on the issue of anti-Semitism in Israel and boycotting and the BDS movement. Another one is Richie Torres. You know, there's a group within the Democratic Party of young congressmen that are not buying into this woke agenda that includes in it a rabid anti-Israel policy. And it's very important, not just in substance of the specific issue you were talking about, but just as a whole, in general, for there to be real pushback within the Democratic Party from the Rising Stars, especially, is tremendously important.
What's next in the case? Like, where have they answered yet, the defense, or where are we at?
As of a week ago, the Office of Civil Rights announced that they will be launching a formal investigation in response to our claim. And now it's essentially, I suppose, an evidentiary gathering exercise. They will need to speak to students, to campus administrators, and so on, to determine exactly what is happening on the ground. If you read our claim, and it's important, we actually refer to members of Congress like Josh, like Richard Torres, like Kevin McCarthy, by the way, as well. So it's something that's, you know, bipartisan in this particular case. Also, students, Jewish groups, faculty members as well, who have really spoken out against this. It's a process that will take some time, but I think we're confident that the facts here really do speak for themselves, and we will get to the bottom of it.
A lot of parents are concerned. These are Israel supporting parents, Jewish, Christian, doesn't matter, are concerned about college campuses these days, but many of them just don't know what's really going on. How bad would you say it is for Jews and Israel supporters on college campuses and universities, I guess?
It's worse. It's worse than you could imagine. Obviously, it depends on each college campus is slightly different. But every conversation that I've had with college students or parents of college students, every time is eye-opening, whether it's in California at the UCs, which are particularly bad, or even on the East Coast, where at a prestigious university outside of Boston, the Hillel director, you know, said, you know, we don't really talk about pro-Israel here because it's a little bit controversial. So really, the students are put in this terrible position where they're basically implicitly being asked to hide their Jewish identity in the four most important years, arguably, in their formative lives, where they're really starting to step out of their shell from their parents' home and step out into the world. And students are being asked unfairly today, but, you know, the world isn't fair, but they're being asked unfairly to stand up and say, okay, now 18 years old is my time to fight for my identity, for my people, and to deal with rabid anti-Semitism. You know, if you ask any students if the BDS movement is anti-Semitic, they'll tell you, because when they walk through the quad on their college campus, you know, 9 times out of 10, nobody's asking them their position on Israel or on the Palestinian conflict. They just see a Jewish student and they're going to attack them. So it's really it's a serious issue. It's a serious issue in the application process. If you speak to any high school seniors, parents, you know, the big question at Jewish day schools today is how much do you include about your Jewish identity in your application? You know, these are serious questions that we've not seen before, at least not in the 42 years that I've been around.
So the quota system is gone, but we're facing an even more difficult and hateful system, I suppose. And I say in all of my talks that we haven't prepared our kids well for college campuses, but I guess part of the issue is, from what I'm hearing from you, this came out of nowhere. It's not exactly happening only in 2022. It's been going on a while, but I think we weren't prepared because we didn't expect this. What can we do to help these kids?
We're certainly, I think, one step that we're taking now with respect to filing this claim against Berkeley is important, because I think what we're showing to them is that we will not stand idly by as they're being discriminated against, harassed, and excluded. So I think first they need to know that we have their backing. And by we, I mean not only us, not only lawyers, but the broader Jewish community as well. It's important that they know that they have their backing, that they have their support when instances like this do arise, and that they have someone to turn to, number one. And number two, I think it's necessary also to provide them with a stronger, perhaps, base of education about Jewish history, Jewish rights, Zionism. What is Zionism? I'm not sure if that is necessarily being fully studied or learned in the preceding years before they hit campus, because once they hit campus, once they hit that, you know, that first week, the orientation week, they are already bombarded with fake apartheid walls and mock checkpoints and so on. And these are kids who are 18, 19, maybe 20 years old, and they're being forced, as Gabe said, to be put in this untenable position now where they have to either hide their identity or renounce their identity just so that they can fit in.
So it's a last question, part A, part B, and one of you could answer one of you could answer the other. You guys decide. I guess to the general population who want to help, how do we make sure that they can get involved so that we have their kids back? Meaning, who should they be looking to? What organizations, what groups, what should they be doing to make sure that they can have their kids back? And then part two is, you know, you raise a very important point, which is educating the kids better. What's your message to the schools, to all of these schools who do educate very well our kids, but maybe need to do a different type of job now, given what's happening when it comes to Jewish identity, pro-Israel, important things like that?
So I guess I'll take the first part. You know, everybody has today an obligation to do something about the rise of anti-Semitism and hate that we see all over really the world. I just came back from a global mayor's conference against anti-Semitism in Athens. We tend in the U.S. to think that the world is U.S.-centric. It's not. On this issue, there's anti-Semitism on the rise in meteoric levels in Europe, in South America, in the United States, in the Middle East. I mean, anywhere you look, you're seeing it. It's different in every place, but it's everywhere. And it's at a point, because we're coming off of a time with big economic unrest, a lot of political unrest and instability all over the world. And those are ripe conditions for anti-Semitism to get to levels that we've seen before in the past, generation after generation, in different places in the world. And the only way we can do things differently in 2022, as we're going into 2023, is for everybody to stand up. So everybody has a toolbox around them, right? The toolbox around them is different. The tools that I have as a lawyer or as a former elected official are some. I grabbed those tools with my friend Arson and we filed this Title VI complaint. Or when I was a mayor, we passed certain resolutions and ordinances to try to push things. Everybody has those toolboxes, whether it's just influencing your family, understanding that Zionism is a part of Judaism. You can't separate those things. And if you want to live in a society that's welcoming and that gives you the opportunity to raise your family and have make a decent living, you know, that's totally inconsistent with a society that allows anti-Semitism to fester. So it's an obligation that everybody has, whether it's at their kitchen table, at their work table, at the water cooler at work. If they write, they should write about it. If they speak, they should speak about it. If they're involved in organizations of any kind, doesn't matter which organization, Jason, if it's if you're talking about immigration, Israel and the Jewish people will come up today. And the question is, what are you going to do there? You're not going to stay quiet, even if you're not Jewish, because that's not the society that you want to live in or you want to raise your kids in.
Jason, I'll just add that, you know, one of the reasons why we have taken such a passionate approach here is that if Berkeley is allowed to get away with this, if an institution of the size of Berkeley, such an esteemed educational, higher education institution, a public institution, if they are allowed to get away with this, where does it stop? Where does it stop? Will workplaces be allowed to say that we will not employ people of a certain ethnic background? Will other public institutions be allowed to get away with this kind of discrimination and bigotry and racism? That is one of the reasons, I think, why we have taken such a forceful and such a passionate approach, specifically with respect to UC Berkeley here. To touch also on really sort of what you on the second part of your question, and I think the case study here is setting a strong precedent. We are not only calling on the revocation of this particular discriminatory and illegal bylaw, but we're also calling for a number of additional steps. And this is important because it's in reference to answering your question, what else can the university do? So we're also calling them to make a clear and unequivocal statement that anti-Zionism is anti-Semitism. We're also calling on them to adopt the IHRA working definition of anti-Semitism, which UC Berkeley has not, which doesn't come as a surprise. By the way, many other campuses, many other universities around America have, but UC Berkeley has not. We're also calling on the university to institute mandatory training for staff and faculty on racism and anti-Semitism, but with that definition of training specifically being grounded in the IHRA definition. And lastly, also, we have called on the university to institute, I suppose, a task force with members of the Jewish community and legal experts and so on to talk about what steps can be taken in order to provide students, faculty and staff, by the way, on campus, a safe environment where they can freely exercise their rights as Jews.
And at the end of the day, Jason, we need to strengthen our Jewish community. We need to strengthen our students. We have to strengthen our children and our friends' children and make them understand that they do not need to check their identity, their religion at the door. They need to walk proudly as Jews, and we'll get through this scourge just like we have in the past. We're in the middle of Hanukkah today, so as we're recording this. So that's really the story of perseverance and fighting against those who were trying to take not just the Greek Syrians that were attacking the Jews and weren't trying to kill us. They were trying to take away our identity as Jews. And that's similar to what we're seeing here. And you know, we'll succeed, but we have to do it with strength, and we have to give the kids the strength to do it.
Totally agree. And I think we also need to stop fighting among ourselves. But Gabe and Arsene, thank you for taking
on this. Thank you, Jason.
Thank you for taking on this fight, such an important fight. Thanks for all you do, and thanks for joining me on The Diplomat.
Pleasure. Thank you.
Well, there you have it, folks. Some really, really important lessons about anti-Semitism, about anti-Zionism, how they really are one and the same. The BDS movement, that hateful BDS movement that hates Jews, hates the state of Israel, the Jewish state of Israel, harms Palestinians, although we didn't get into that. That would be a whole podcast or multiple podcasts in and of itself. The terrible action by these clubs at Berkeley Law, the importance of the civil rights claim brought by Gabe Groisman and Arsene Ostrovsky, two very talented attorneys. If you found it interesting, please do share it. Frankly, share it anyway. It's really important stuff. I'm Jason Greenblatt. This is The Diplomat, brought to you by Newsweek. And please don't forget to pick up a copy of my book if you have not heard it yet, if you have not read it yet. It's available on both Audible. It's available wherever you buy your books. Listen to it. It ties very much into this issue and into the state of Israel, the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, and today's Middle East. Again, I'm Jason Greenblatt. This is The Diplomat, brought to you by Newsweek.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Corient. Corient provides wealth management services centered around you. They focus on exceeding your expectations and simplifying your life. Corient has been helping high achievers just like you enjoy their lives more fully, preserve their wealth, and provide for the people, causes, and communities they care about. As one of the largest integrated fee-only registered investment advisors in the U.S., Corient has deeply experienced teams in 23 strategic locations. Corient has extensive knowledge spanning the full spectrum of planning, investing, lending, and money management disciplines. Leverage Corient's exclusive network of experts to craft custom solutions designed to help you reach your financial goals, no matter how complex they may be. Real wealth requires real solutions. For more information, connect with a wealth advisor today at Corient.com. That's Corient.com. Corient.com.